Today's Taisho will be on case 51 in the Blue Rock Collection. Seppo's What Is This? Engo's Introduction. If you have the slightest choice of right and wrong, you will fall into confusion of mind. If you are not caught up in the ranks, there will be no groping in the dark. Tell me, which is advisable, letting go or holding fast? At this point, if you deal in terms of concepts and remain attached to sophisticated thinking, you are a ghost clinging to weeds and bushes. Even if you become innocent of such vulgarity, you are still thousands of miles from your true home. Do you understand? If not, just study the present koan. See the following. Main subject. When Seppo was living in his hermitage, two monks came to pay their respects. As Seppo saw them, he pushed open the gate and, presenting himself before them, said, "What is this?" The monks also said, "What is this?" Seppo lowered his head and returned to his cottage. Later, the monks came to Ganto, who said, "Where are you from?" The monks answered, "We have just come from south of Nanrei Mountains." Ganto said, "Have you ever been to see Seppo there?" The monks said, "Yes, we have been to see him." Ganto said, "What did he say to you?" The monks related the whole story. Ganto said, "Alas, I regret that I did not tell him the last word when I was with him. If I had done so, no one in the whole world could have pretended to outdo him." At the end of the summer session, the monks repeated the story and asked Ganto for instruction. Ganto said, "Why didn't you ask earlier?" The monks said, "We have a hard time struggling with this topic." Ganto said, "Seppo came to life in the same way that I did, but he does not die in the same way that I do. If you want to know the last word, I'll tell you simply. This, this." Secho's verse. The last word let me tell you. Light and darkness intermingle. Living in the same way you all know. Dying in different ways beyond telling. Absolutely beyond telling. Buddha and Dharma only nod to themselves. East, west, north and south. Homeward let us go. Late at night, seeing the snow on the thousand peaks. This is the second day, for many people here, this is the second day of the Sesshin, and you're struggling a little bit with the physical difficulties. It's usually the case on the second day of the Sesshin that your legs begin to hurt and your back begins to get tired, and the physical challenges become more significant. And so I hope you won't let this, throw you. It can be kind of a shock. I can remember the first Sesshin I did many, many years ago, more than 30 years ago. And I had only been practicing for a couple of weeks formally. I had started sitting at the Seattle Zen Center, and there was this beautiful Japanese woman named Wendy Nakao, Japanese-American woman. And she was at that time, I think, the sort of the leader of the group. And Genki Roshi had just arrived from Japan, and she was organizing the Sesshin, or a Sesshin, the first Sesshin, one of the first Sesshins of their group. And I had been coming to the university and doing Zazen for just a little while, and I really liked it. But I hadn't really, you know, getting through 20 minutes was a real difficult feat for me, getting through 25 minutes. And by the end, I would be like, you know, just barely unable to keep from moving. So then we went to Sesshin, and it was just a shock. And the way it worked was that I was sitting at the university, and Wendy at the end of the sit said, and who would like to volunteer for Sesshin? And I didn't know what Sesshin was. So I didn't say anything. And then she came up to me very brightly with this beautiful smile. She said, would you like to go to Sesshin? And I just thought she was so beautiful. I said, yes, you know. And the next thing I knew, I was sitting on a cushion in a remote part of Washington State. And we were sitting a 45-minute sit. Genki Roshi had just come from Japan, and he didn't understand really our background. So he was doing the same length of sitting that they probably do at Daitokuji, you know. So he said, or maybe he thought he was being easy. He said, let's, 45. That sounds reasonable. And I'll tell you, 45-minute sits, every sit, you know. I mean, I could barely have done 45 minutes if I were rested and had, you know, a good breakfast and everything else, you know. So after a couple 45-minute sits, I was ready to go to the hospital. And so I don't remember much of that sesshin, really. I remember being in excruciating pain a lot of the time. And I remember going in to see Genki Roshi, and I remember just when I would lean down to sit on the zafu, the round cushion, you know, my legs just hurt so much. I sort of remember sort of crawling over to sit in front of him in agony. And he was so kind, you know, I thought he was so, he was such a gentle person. And he was, it just melted my heart that he was so kind. And he said, I know you're in great pain. And I, at the time, I probably thought, how can, you know, he must be so observant. But probably anybody looking at me could see I was in agony. I was probably bent over, hunched over. So anyway, I got through that sesshin somehow. And I remember also that we sat in a place at that time. There was a zendo and a big room, and off the room there was a kitchen. And so basically all the food was prepared in advance. There was no door on the kitchen. So you know, there was cooking going on in the kitchen. And, you know, most of the cooking had been done in advance, so really it was just like heating the food. But, you know, there was a little bit of noise from the kitchen while we were all sitting. You know, it was a little bit like my house where we used to have, at one time there was no door on the door between the living room and the kitchen. And so people would be sitting there and I would be cooking. And Wendy did the cooking then too. And it was delicious, mostly Japanese food, very healthy and nutritious. And sometimes at night there were rats in the kitchen, we could hear them squeaking. And this was really out in the country, so they were, you know, forest type rats. You know. Anyway. We heard them squeaking one night, and Genki Roshi gave instructions that all the food was to be covered up. But he said that where he was raised in Japan, rats were considered a good omen. He said that basically if a rat lives somewhere, it must be pretty good. And so he said, we don't want to hurt the rats. So I was so moved by that, I just thought I'd really like to study with this guy. And a number of years later, my wife went to work for an import company called the Shiga Import Company in Seattle. And she became good friends with the wife of the owner, Toshimo Shiga. And Toshimo told me that on her farm, she would come into the barn and she would see, you know, like all of these tails hanging down off of the rafters, rat tails. And her father didn't want anybody to hurt the rats. Now, interesting. I doubt that this is a universal value in Japan, but maybe in old time, country people had this kind of reverence for life, you know. Of course, you know that in India, they actually have a temple to rats, you know, just a temple to snakes and so on, monkeys. Everything belongs here somehow. So when Genki Roshi said that about rats, I just thought, oh, who is this guy? You know, what a wonderful teacher. I'd love to study with him. But anyway, it was hard to get through the first sesshin, and I very much sympathize with you if this is your first sesshin, and I'm really impressed that everybody's doing such a good job, and that you have sat so quietly this morning. Please don't forget my invitation to sit in a chair. There's nothing disgraceful about sitting in a chair. Many of the people here have done that on occasion. Sometimes you just need a time out, and you sit on the cushion, and then you sit on the chair, and then you feel restored. You get your strength back, and you can go back to the cushion. Please keep up the good work and understand that I think I know what you're going through. Everybody here has been, everybody here has been through that. You know, eventually, I promise this is the case, that, discomfort is really at a minimum. When you sit after 30 years, generally speaking, the sits are very beautiful and there's no pain. And, you know, when you get tired at the end of the day, when I'm doing Dokusan, for example, my legs get very tired just from sitting so much. But eventually, there won't be much pain. There'll be, minimal pain. And it'll be quite different. But, I can remember just every sit, having, just pushing against the pain, and going back to my room and just jumping into bed, and just trying to pass out as quickly as possible. You know. And the interesting thing is that, your body has amazing recuperative powers. Last night, when I went to bed, my legs were quite sore and tired from doing so much sitting. And I noticed that, especially my left knee, which I think I injured about a couple months ago, was giving me a lot of trouble, and when I woke up in the morning, it just felt great. All those beans we ate last night, went into my system, and they mended all the little tissues and everything, and our bodies have remarkable recuperative powers. So, just hang in there. Don't get discouraged. Don't listen to the voices of discouragement in your head. If you hang in there, something wonderful will happen to you. I really promise that's true. When you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching the breath, you can find a place inside yourself that's absolutely still. It takes a long time to discover this sometime. But, especially in the morning, I find, the mind's rather clear. When we get up and we come in and we do the sutras and then we have a little break and you sit down, your legs are not as tired as they might be later in the day. And you have a chance to really get into your breath, really get into the breath. And if you're not feeling bad and you're fooling around mentally, you're thinking about this and that, you're missing a golden opportunity. So it's probably a good idea, in the morning when you're sitting, to think, okay, I know I'm going to have pain later, So I better get ready now, better get ready for it. And the way to get ready for it is to really deeply engage with the breath. So, you know, you squeeze your dantian, your hara, and the breath goes out, 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 out. And, at first, you're just sort of watching the breath, but you want to get so close to your breath that you're sort of going out with the breath, you know. You want to just fuse your attention with your breath. And sooner or later, the breath, watching the breath like this is going to give you great mental stillness. You're suddenly going to realize that you're, and maybe you won't realize it on the cushion, but when you get off the cushion, you'll notice that your mind feels kind of different. It's like you're in something. It's like being in water, you know, or I don't know how to put it, but you'll notice that there's a real qualitative difference to your consciousness. And if you observe your mind, you'll notice that there are many fewer thoughts, and your mind is just resting more calmly in the present moment. And this is a very important breakthrough. Even if your legs are screaming with pain, probably when you get off the cushion, your mind is actually very, you'll notice your mind is actually very still. And so this stillness is extremely important. It's the foundation for all subsequent Zen meditation practice. Yesterday I said that Zen is not about stillness or silence. I meant stillness or silence in the external world. Basically, we want to find a kind of stillness in the mind, in ourselves. And it's there, and it's real, and it's imperturbable, believe it or not. And when you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching the breath and you're preparing for the pain to come, if you really grab the breath with your mind, it'll take you deeper and deeper into a kind of still mental stillness. And you can get so deep. Now, you know, once the pain begins to arise, you have like a flight or fight mechanism. You know, people naturally want to run away, or they get mad, or, you know, you might try to beat it up or something, beat up your, none of that's going to work. What you need to do is as the pain arises, follow the breath out, and you can kind of sweep the pain away if you'd like. So when you focus single-mindedly on your breath, as the breath goes out, 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 as you're single-mindedly following the breath out, you'll notice that the pain awareness recedes and basically may disappear altogether. And when you run out of breath, the pain will probably come back. And then you sweep the pain away again. You go out, out, out with the breath. And you'll notice again that the pain goes away and then it comes back when you run out of breath. And so there'll be intervals that in which there's no pain or little pain. And you can sort of deepen those intervals and make them longer just by attending to your breath, just by focusing on the breath. This is like a basic strategy that I use every day, you know. When I sit on the cushion, I've been doing this for 30 years, but I do the same thing. I don't count, but I call mu. And when I say mu, on the out-breath, everything disappears. This is a zero awareness of anything, anything. And then, when I reach the end of my breath, a pain sensation arises or awareness of noise or something, and then I go back and I do it again. And as I do this, my mind is sinking deeper and deeper, 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 deeper into something hard to describe. But in that state, you know, you'll eventually be able to find a condition of awareness in which your mind becomes imperturbable. And it's not so easy to find at first, but once you find it, you'll never be the same. I really think that's true. You'll just never be the same. You realize that there's a kind of a still center at the very heart of your consciousness. Yeah? And that you know, it is true that in that center you're still aware on the margin that there's some pain sensation. But when you're really in it, and you almost, it's almost like the pain is like laughable, you know, it's like laughing at the pain. You know, you just feel so almost like invulnerable or indestructible. And I have to say, this happened to me yesterday. You know, like everybody else, I struggle with discomfort. You know, I have pain in my legs. And so I really began to focus on my breath. I straightened my back and I worked with my hara, my dantian, and I just really gripped my my breath and my mu. And as I did this, you know, I began to just feel like this tremendous stillness opening up. And then usually there's like this surge of energy, right? And it's just like, I just felt indestructible, you know? And it was just so great. It just felt fantastic. You know? The first time this happened to me was at a sesshin, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago. We were sitting in a place called Moses Lake in eastern Oregon, and it was very hot. Not eastern Oregon, eastern Washington. And it was very hot, and the coyotes were howling at night. It was pretty cool. And it was a full moon, like the last night or tonight. And Mount St. Helens went off during that sesshin, by the way. Mount St. Helens was a volcano that erupted. This was probably before many of you were born, so I forgot that you wouldn't know about that. I was sitting in pain and going into my breath, and then all of a sudden I hit this place that was like indestructible. And I was just astounded. I just felt like, my God, you know, this is it. I've conquered pain, you know. And so I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I said, Roshi, I've done it, and where I am, it's just there's no pain. And I said, I'll never be in pain again. You know? And of course, the next day I got up and was like, oh, my legs. So it takes a little concentration. You have to work. You do it one breath at a time, one breath at a time. But little by little, you can find this place. And people who have been practicing for 6 or 7 years, 10 years, can forget all about this. You know, they can get kind of sloppy with their practice. But if you really work with the pain, it can deepen your practice enormously. I mean, I hate to say this, but if there were no pain, it would be difficult to make much progress. You know. We all have this tendency to try to work intellectually with our problems, even koans, you know. So if you have a koan and you, you can try to think it through or something like that. But when you're in pain, you can't think anymore like that. It's just the pain doesn't allow you to think, or you realize that these are just fantasies, you know. And then you just have to try to survive on the cushion. And when you're just trying to survive, that's such a great condition of being. When you're just trying to survive, it's just, let me just get through the next 25 minutes, right? And it's just, you're just holding on to one breath after another. It has a way of beautifully simplifying existence, yeah? And clarifying. You know, what we're doing really is purifying body, mind, and heart. The problem, why aren't we, you know, all the sutras say that human consciousness is inherently enlightened. But when you come to sesshin, it may be the case that you feel very far from enlightenment. And it's because of our karmic obstacles, our psychological obstacles. So, you know, if you're working on a koan, if you're working on, say, the mu koan, you know, it takes a long time sometimes you have to sit in that darkness or that blankness for a long time before something happens. And a lot of the mu koan is just staying in that darkness or that blankness long enough to undergo a kind of transformation. You know, it's like a person who has wandered into a cave and can't see anything for a while. But eventually your eyes adjust and you begin to see. You know, this is a little bit like the mu koan, you know. At first you're calling mu and maybe your mind becomes a little blank. And you might think, well, what's this about? What's this all about? You know? But you just have to stay in that darkness, stay in that blankness until something changes. Something is going to happen to you. And until that happens, you just have to keep waiting patiently. It's like there's a door between ourselves and our big mind, between our little mind and our big mind. And we've locked it because we're afraid. And as we grow up, we live more and more in the small self. And we get out of touch with this mysterious power, which is at the heart of our lives. We become more and more unhappy and dead. So at some point we decide to practice Zen, and the teacher says, why don't you try doing mu? And you watch mu go out, 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 and your mind becomes dark. And maybe you don't have so much pain all the time, but you just sit there in a kind of blankness, or it's sort of like a blankness, just nothing happens. And you need to just be patient and stay there until like your eyes adjust, basically. Another way to put it is that the door between yourself, when you're doing mu koan, the mu koan, every time you call mu, it's like you're knocking on the door between your little mind and your big mind. And basically the door is going to open at some point, and big mind is going to come out. And of course people are scared that big mind might come out and eat them up like a monster in the fairy tales, you know. But actually big mind isn't going to eat you up, it's going to make you, if you're old, it's going to make you young again. And if you're young, it's going to make you even more alive. So please don't be afraid of what's on the other side of that door. You just have to have patience. And you go through many things when you're working with the mu koan, you know. Boredom, anger, frustration. You can experience a kind of deadness. You know, sometimes people just feel, you know, they're just in this dead blankness, day after day after day. You know? But don't be daunted. You just have to stay there. Really the problem is, you know, we just don't trust. We just get locked up. Our karma keeps us locked up. We think I said the door was locked, but it's really not. You know, we're holding it shut. The big mind's trying to get through, but we keep holding it shut and imagining it's locked. So you just have to keep working with that emptiness until you begin to change, until your heart begins to melt and you're able to let go enough to have something very special happen to you. Now, after you've worked with the mu koan, it may be the case that you're working with another koan, or will definitely be the case. That too is a kind of an adjustment. It's kind of an adjustment. Because after the mu koan, what happens with the mu koan is that there's eventually a reunification, even if it's just temporary, between big mind and little mind. And it's like you're possessed by a part of yourself that you've normally locked up. It's like a divine possession, you could say. And it's like for a while, this power reaches into your life and you feel this tremendous energy. And this is like a unified unified mind in accord with the way, what Seng Tsang calls a unified mind in accord with the way. When the little mind and the big mind are unified again, you're a fully functioning human being. And people have a little breakthrough with the Mu Koan and they become fully functioning human beings for a little while, but then their karma, their fears and obstacles intervene and they close up again. This is just inevitable. So it would be nice if we could just, you know, come in and have a breakthrough and that would be it, but even when we have a breakthrough, we close the door a little bit again. So then it's on to the next koan. And, you know, basically, when you're working with a koan after the mu koan, you're really struggling with your obstacles. You know, all of these koans are aimed at forcing us or designed to force us to confront some of our obstacles. So you know, even koans that sound trivial are really very much like a medicine that we have to take that might be a little bitter, you know. So there might be a koan like, show what is the sound of one hand clap? So many of these koans are kind of happy, you know, they sound happy. What is the sound of one hand clapping, right? You think, oh, that's funny, right? How funny. Or maybe there's a koan that goes like this. I want you to be the tea ladle in the tea ceremony, in the cha do. Now the tea ladle goes into the hot water and into the cold water, and into the hot water and into the cold. And you might think, oh, that's funny, you know, tea ladle. That's fun, you know. It's like the teacher saying, be a pickle. Okay, I'll be a pickle. You know, this should be easy. But actually, these koans are devilishly clever, you know, because usually they touch on something that is very like raw nerves in ourselves. You know, so the koan is saying, you have created a barrier in yourself, and you're resting calmly in a dead condition. And now it's time to come back to life, but it's going to be a little difficult. And how is it going to be difficult? Well, you have to confront your obstacles. And people would rather not do that. So, you know, it's easy to, like, I'm just speaking from experience, you know. I mean, I've had, I've spent years on some of these koans because I just didn't want to confront or couldn't, wasn't psychologically ready, wasn't that I didn't want to, but just couldn't, you know, not ready. But at some point, you know, koans are amazing because they sink down into your unconscious. And I'm just amazed, you know, you give somebody a koan and they're not using their discriminating intellect. And they come into the Dokusan room and it's like they're right on the money, you know, just entering into deep mushin. The koan sinks down into the unconscious mind and it begins to direct them. It starts giving them directions and they start moving in the right direction. But, you know, there can be some hesitation because the koan is trying to liberate you from your obstacles. Now, it's hard work. You know, every step, have you noticed that every step of Zen practice is rather hard work? You know, just a fact. It's hard work to deal with pain. But I promise you the rewards are quite great. And it's hard work to sit in blankness for 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. And yet, you know, it's really quite wonderful when the door opens. And it's hard work to deal with these koans, you know. Hakuin Zenji called them vile koans. He said, "Oh, those vile koans," you know, because you know it's difficult. It's painful and difficult sometimes to have to work with to confront our obstacles. And you know, the goal of Zen practice is very lofty. It's enlightenment, right? So, I mean, it's important to remind yourself that you haven't come here for a trivial thing. You've come here for, like, what I consider to be the highest goal, you know, enlightenment, you know. All over the United States, people go to these, like, seminars on self-improvement. And I'm not, I guess I am criticizing. I am criticizing. You know, they go to these things, and it's like, you know, how to be, you know, a better person or something like this. And, you know, there's a place for these things because it expresses a human desire to change. But it's so shallow. It's like, you know, you get a little workbook, you know, and they give you a little triangle, and this is the self, this is the world, and this is others, you know. And you have to travel around the triangle, you know, and you keep, you know, the workshop, you'll take a problem, now go from the top of the triangle down to the, you know, and then people can share, you know, sit in a circle and go, well, you know, ever since I've been working with a triangle, I realize, you know. I just think this is very shallow, if I may say so, you know. Because it's just working on the level of intellectual ideas, you know, and very shallow. It doesn't take much work, actually, to do that kind of thing, but the results are very small, they're very modest. Now, I'm not saying it has no result, but very modest result. It would be very unlikely, for example, if you had been, molested as a child, that working with the triangle would help you, or if you had a substance abuse problem, right? I mean, at that, when you begin to look at real problems, you realize those kinds of solutions are involve a great deal of wish fulfillment and fantasy. Yeah. Now, you know, something like psychoanalysis, people will tell you, you know, it's difficult to go through psycho, because then you really have to work with your obstacles. Yeah. Actually, you know, the goal of psychoanalysis is a very important thing to be aware of. You know, the founder of psychoanalysis was Sigmund Freud. And Freud said, the goal of psychoanalysis is to take people from abject misery and restore them to ordinary unhappiness. See? That's all psychoanalysis ever aims to do. And I'm not criticizing it, because it's tremendously helpful. You know, but the goal, it understands that, you know, the most, or Freud felt, the most that we can aim for is just to be not abjectly miserable, but ordinarily unhappy. You know, the discontent is our lot in life, alienation is inescapable, and so on. You know, so this is the perspective, and, you know, but it's hard work just to go from misery to unhappiness. But the goal of Zen is very lofty. It's enlightenment, you know. So naturally, it's going to involve some work. But Buddha was a little less pessimistic than Freud about the human condition, because he said that people can achieve enlightenment, and that you know, fortunately, it doesn't take 20 years. We begin to have little enlightenment experiences. On the cushion all the time. So, you know, maybe you're in pain all day, and then all of a sudden you have this beautiful sit where your pain recedes and you're just purely in the moment and everything is so alive and you're so happy. And there's no reason, you just are. So that's like, that's a little enlightenment experience. And then, you know, unfortunately you can't stay there because karma, mental habits, kick in and we close up again. So then we keep working and there's another opening and then we close up again. And this keeps happening, right? Opening, closing, opening, closing. This is like Zen practice. And the opening can get quite significant. You know, some people can encounter the source temporarily. And they have like an opening, and they see very clearly in enlightened mind, but then it goes away. See, so in that case, it's just a glimpse of something. It's not enlightenment, it's a glimpse of enlightenment. And these are like enlightenment experiences, but not daikensho, maybe I should put it that way. You have an opening, but you close up. You have an opening, but you close up. And at some point, people can have an opening and see enlightened mind very clearly, and then it closes up. And it's very, that's a complex situation, because the person could say, well, I've seen it. Now I can kick back and take it easy. But that's not a daikensho, because it's not a permanent transformation. It's just a glimpse. So if it's not here now, it's not daikensho. So what happens in daikensho is you encounter a fundamental awareness in a permanent way, and it's a deep psychological transformation. It's meeting a source face to face, and not from a distance. So this is Zen practice, and it's always about coming back to the present moment. You know, as I was talking about, I've been talking about this a lot, but your salvation, your enlightenment, is right here, but you have to clear away the obstacles. You know, when these two monks came to see Seppo, he's a famous Zen master, and he lives up in the mountains. And they heard that this great Zen master Seppo is living there, and they decide to go visit him. And he sees him coming, and he comes out, and he says, what is this? And this is a Zen question. He's saying, tell me about this moment right now. So he comes out of the house and he says, what is this? See? And they say, they repeat what he said, what is this? See, so they're just imitating him. They're just doing what they think will make him happy or make him think they're enlightened or something. And he's so, he lowers his head and goes back to his cottage. It's like, well, you know, you guys have to, you're not in the moment, you know, you're not doing Zen practice. You know, it's not about it's not about imitating me, it's not about coming up with a good answer, it's about being totally present in this moment. And in that state that I talked about, of serene immovability. See, in order to really be present in the moment, you have to find that still point, that still imperturbable point. And we get there to varying degrees, but once we're there, we can see things as they really are. It still takes a lot of work, but from that place you can begin to dissolve your obstacles. Sometimes when you're working with a koan, it just gets the better of you. You lose your mental balance and you can't go forward. Just go back to move. And then go back into the koan, little by little, see? You dissolve your barriers. Just like working with pain, it's the same process. So anyway, then the monks come to Ganto, and he says, where are you from? And they said, we were up in the mountains, and he said, oh, you were up in those mountains. Did you ever run into my old pal Seppo? Because they know each other. They tell him what happened. They said, yeah, he came out of the hut, he said, what is this? And we said, what is this? And he just went back into the hut. And Ganto is trying to get them to, he's trying to arouse in them a kind of what you would call doubt sensation. Well, he says it's pure baloney, by the way. He just makes up something to get them worried or interested, right? It's just like thing he makes up to get them worried, create doubt. And doubt doesn't mean like, why am I at Sashin? You may have those doubts, but doubt means, see, I mean, the motive in practicing Zen is a lofty motive. It's enlightenment. You know, I mean, look, either all, you know, Buddhism in general, and Zen in particular, is not about faith. You know, don't take it on faith, whatever you do, okay? This is about, we want to know. It's please excuse me, but it's either bullshit or it's not, right? So we want to know. You know, maybe life is just you're born, you suffer, and you die, right? I want to know if that's really how it is or not, you know? Or maybe there is a kind of connection to things. Maybe there is something like enlightenment, but I'm not going to take it on faith. I refuse. I want to know. And I want to know so badly that I'm willing to sit in agony for hours, but I want to know. See, that is Zen. That is Zen. This is not about faith, it's about knowing. So, you know, somebody gives you a crazy koan, and you're sitting on the cushion, and all of a sudden it just hits you like a ton of bricks. And you come in and you say this, and I say, oh, good, that's it. See, I didn't tell you that. You didn't find it in a scripture. It came right out of your body, mind, and heart. It came right out of Mu. See? And you can't, you know, you don't have to doubt it. You can't doubt it because it just came out of you, right? So you know. You might not know what it means. See, you might have no, I don't know what the heck this means or how I know it. But, you know, it's this. That's coming from you. That's your answer. You're not living somebody else's life or finding somebody else's truth. It's coming right out of your mouth because it's coming out of your body, your heart, your mind. The Zen path is about, I've got to know. See? And so these monks are just fooling around. They're wasting their own time. Seppo comes out and says, what is it? And they go, oh, what is it? They parrot him. And it's just like, oh, well, you guys are wet behind the ears, right? And he goes to meet the other Ganto. Ganto says, gee, these guys are really in a bad situation because they're far from the truth and they don't even know it yet. So then he gives them this little story that will get them worried and they'll go back to the cushion because now they have the doubt sensation, the doubt sensation. So you know, the goal is enlightenment. And if you're not there yet and you know you're not there yet, good. So let's keep going. We want to know, and we want to see it face to face with our whole being. And I think that's a magnificent way to live. It takes great courage, you know, great courage, great determination. I admire everybody in this room so much for having those qualities. But I believe, you know, the rewards are really amazing. You have to find out for yourself. But in my opinion, you know, I cannot say I've been even in the least bit disappointed. All I can say is, in my opinion, I don't deserve the life I have. It's too good a life. It's been too beautiful. It's been too wonderful. And I can't repay, if I work from now until the time I die, I can't repay the universe for the happiness I feel. That's my answer. You have to find your own answer. But I would say if you walk this path, you won't be disappointed. So, let's keep going.